At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
It's the 16th of April, 1972, at Flower Lodge, Cork. Waterford fans are trudging out of the ground. They're 2-0 down to 10 men, with 10 minutes to go as they play their league rivals, Cork Hibernians. Waterford only needed a draw to be champions. That, as they say, must be that. Earlier on, Dave Wigginton and the great Maya Dennehy had gotten through on goal, tried to walk the ball past the goalkeeper Peter Thomas, but had inadvertently strayed offside. It would have been 3-0. Waterford captain Alfie Hale jokingly turns to the Hibs players Dave Bakuzi and Nola Mahoney and says, "You may regret that." And they would. First, Carol Humphrey scores, then Johnny Murphy scores from the spot, and incredibly, it's 2-2. If Waterford hold on, they're champions. What happens next, Hale explains in his own words in an article from the Irish Examiner with Liam McKay. "We won a free kick on the right-hand side of the box, and John O'Neill lined it up. The strange thing is that the two of us never practiced free kicks together in all those years, but we had a great eye for looking up and seeing me make a move or give him a signal. It was kind of a chemistry between us." He told me afterwards that just to run down the clock, he thought about belting the ball over the heads of the crowd behind the goal. But halfway into his run-up, he suddenly saw me running off Nola Mahoney, and he stuck it right in front of me, where I love to see it, and I headed it past Joe O'Grady. 3-2, and Waterford were champions in the most dramatic, scarcely believable way. League of Ireland in the 1970s had an incredible mix of great teams vying for league and cup glory. Waterford FC, Cork Hibernians, Cork Celtic, Bohemians, Dundalk, Limerick United, Drogheda, Finn Harps, Shamrock Rovers, Home Farm and Sligo Rovers would all find their way to glory in the 70s. Ironically, at a point in League of Ireland history when people began to walk away from domestic football. And we're about to find out why. Hello and welcome to this week's Green Shoots, a history of Irish football with me, Caelan Kerwin, along with the football knowledge master that is Gary Spain. You can subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you listen to us on, whether it's Spotify, Apple, Amazon Music or YouTube Podcast and more. You can find us there. Share the show on your social media as well and help to spread the word about the podcast and, of course, Irish footballing history. So let's get on with the show. So, Gary, when we, I suppose the last time we left off the League of Ireland, when we were chatting about it, we kind of left off around about the late 60s, early 1970s. I suppose in the decade to come, give us a little insight into what was to come in the League of Ireland and what we'll be talking about in the show this week.
Yeah, so it was very much all change in the 70s in the League of Ireland. We saw the demise of Drumcondra, the famous Northside Dublin club who had been so successful. The rise of Bohemians, they had been successful in the past, but their amateur ethos had basically hurt them badly in the 50s and 60s, and they became a nowhere club, really finishing bottom of the league a lot of the time. So they turned professional and it was hugely successful. In the early part of the decade, it was certainly Munster on top. But as you moved on into the late 70s, Bohemians, the likes of Dundalk, came to the fore. And unfortunately, it was also the demise of the great crowds going to the League of Ireland. I think in Dublin, it saw the demise in the early 70s and following that in Munster as well.
Yeah, let's take it from, because for that Bohemians part, if we go back to 1969, for them, it's a big change for Bohemians as a football club. They professionalized. I suppose, first of all, where does the decision come to actually take a step like that?
Well, the Bohemians have been fan-owned members club since they were founded way back in 1890. They had been successful in the old Irish League and in the League of Ireland. I mean, in the 20s, they won every trophy available to them. They won leagues and cups right into the 40s, and their amateur ethos didn't impact them as such. But as football moved on, became more professional in the 40s into the 50s, they couldn't hold on to their players, and they were basically struggling in the lower echelons of the table for the 50s and the 60s. And Tony O'Connell made a decision, as you said, in 1969 to make Bowes professional. And I suppose that also coincided with the other great Northside club, Drumcondra. Their crowds were dwindling, their success, and things were going wrong for them. And they actually ended up going out of business in 1972-73. So I suppose it left the North Side free for Bohemians as well.
It's interesting that, because, and I'll get back to the professionalism kind of part of it in a little bit, but we kind of mentioned it before, there's very big kind of similarities between Drumcondra and Belfast Celtic in terms of a big club that did win things, they were successful, and then they fade and they disappear and they're no more. And that kind of gap, that hole that's left there, gets kind of taken up by, in this case, we'll say Bohemians, or in Belfast, it was probably Glentoran or somebody like that. So is it fair to say that kind of the demise of one kind of helps the aids the other?
Well, I think it is fair to say. I mean, maybe some historians might argue that, but I think it would have been much more difficult for Bohemians to be as successful as they were, as quickly as they were, having turned professional, without the demise of Drumcondra at the same time. Now you can maybe argue that they could have fed off each other, but I don't. I actually think, and in fact, Bohemians were the preeminent club in Dublin for much of the 70s, because I talked about the demise of Drumcondra. I mean, Shamrock Rovers, now Rovers did have a playoff for the title in 1971, but after that, they went into decline, really, and until the arrival of Johnny Giles, which is another story. But it's fair to say Bohemians, they turned professional in 1969, and they saw immediate results. And I think they really benefited from the fact that Drums were in decline, Rovers were heading for decline as well. Pats and Shells probably wasn't a good time for them. And actually, the trophies and the power in Irish football was very much in the south, in Munster at the time.
And that switch from professionalism to professionalism, it does have an immediate impact. They win the cup in 1970, the FAI Cup. Is that because of professionalism, or were they on the cusp of that kind of success beforehand?
Well, that's because they turned professional. I mean, they were able to sign players. Now, if you talk to people in Sligo, Sligo Rovers have so many hard luck stories in the FAI Cup, and some of them are absolutely justified. And if I even mention 1978, it's going to send shivers down the spine of Sligo fans.
We tend to keep reminding them of that over the decades every time
you mention Sligo Rovers.
Remember that lost.
I will go on to talk about arguably the most famous and possibly the best referee of all time, but he certainly is not popular in certain quarters, including Sligo. But in 1970, Bohemians won the cup. Now, it took three games. It actually, they drew twice, and they eventually won at the third time of asking. Sligo were probably the better team over those games. Certainly, if you talk to Sligo Rovers fans, 1970 is one that got away. Other than, as far as I know, it's the fault was not in the referee in that case. It was just maybe bad luck or something like that. And Sligo have had a lot of hard luck stories in the FAI Cup over the years. But it was a huge coup for Bowes to win the cup. They hadn't won it since the 1940s. I think it's actually the 19th. Yeah, they certainly didn't win it in the 50s and 60s anyway. And so it was a huge coup for them to win the cup, to get some success. And that followed on into the 70s. And Billy Young's side They won a couple of leagues. They were very competitive, and they were a very strong team of the 1970s. Not great to watch, I'll say. I mean, I remember them, the Markets Field in the 70s. They were built on a very, very solid defence. They were really tough to score against. And if you talk about later times, 1-0 to the Arsenal and George Graham's Arsenal, that Bohemians team of the 70s were very, very tough to beat.
And it's interesting they say that, because in our last podcast where I interviewed Pat Fenlon, he kind of mentioned, you know, great teams or good teams, teams that definitely go on and win leagues are usually centered around having good defenses. That's where you build, and you build your whole kind of ethos around the team, because if you can stop teams from scoring, that's your first hurdle overcome, really, isn't it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, as they say, I think it's an American saying, but if they say offense wins games, but defense wins championships. Absolutely. You know? And you're not going to, even if you're scoring goals for fun, if you're leaving them in at the other end, it's very hard to win much.
But the while it comes with immediate success in the cup, they don't win a league title till the mid 70s. So it was, I suppose, a little bit. Was it frustrating, perhaps, for Bowes that they thought this immediate success was coming, but they were up against obviously a good Waterford side, Cork Celtic, etc. So it took a time for them to impact the league in terms of winning it. They were second and third and stuff.
Yeah, it did take some time. And I mean, another club that came in at the time were Finn Harps, who actually challenged at the top in the early 70s. But you mentioned the Waterford side. We did talk about them. We touched on them before. That Waterford side won 6 leagues in 8 seasons. They were probably another club with hard luck stories in the FAI Cup, including a couple of defeats in Limerick. But they were the dominant side. They won 6 league titles, some incredible players there. And then you mentioned Cork Celtic. We talked about Cork Hibs before as well. Hibs probably feel they could have won another couple of titles. They won the league in 71, beating Shamrock Rovers in that playoff. Hibs won the cup in 72 and 73. We talked before about that famous game in Flower Lodge when Waterford came in the league decider on the last day. Waterford came from 2-0 down with 10 men to defeat Hibs 3-2. A week later, Hibs beat them in the cup final, a Maya Dennehy hat-trick. I mean, they were titanic battles at the time, but that Waterford side were incredibly strong, and they were another team with a very good defence, but also with some power, potency and attack. So it's not surprising that Bowes didn't get immediate success by turning professional. It did take a few years. But certainly the power and the axis of Irish football in the early 70s was very much in Munster.
Yeah, and if you look at the 70s as well, it seems like an incredibly competitive period in the League of Ireland. You had some very, very good teams kind of around the country too, in terms of, like, you had Waterford, Finn Harps were good, Bohemians come along, Cork Hibs, Cork Celtic. So there's a lot of, like, people jostling for that place at the top, isn't there?
Yeah, it was very competitive. And I mean, I have to mention, I know we did talk about it before, but Limerick winning the cup in 1971 as well. Although in fairness, I would have to say Limerick were not really competitive or competing at the top of the league at the time. But certainly that FAI Cup success was huge in the city. But as you say, Waterford, they were always there or thereabouts. 6 leagues in 8 seasons. They had won 3 in a row in 68, 69 and 70. So they had been incredibly dominant. Lost the 68 Cup final to Shamrock Rovers. As I mentioned, a couple of cup defeats in that period against Limerick. They fell away a little bit in 71, but they think they were still third or fourth, and not that far up behind Hibs and Rovers, who finished dead level and had to play off in Dalymount Park for the title. Hibs actually winning that one. Waterford came back again. They won the league in 1972 and they won it again in 1973. as I said, to complete 6 and 8 seasons. Hibs beat them in the 72 Cup final. How they lifted themselves off the floor, having effectively blown the title a week earlier in Flower Lodge. I mean, in front of 25,000 people, 2-0 up, 10 minutes to go against 10 men. And it was an incredible comeback, an epic. Now, Waterford only needed a draw, but they came back and won 3-2. Incredible, epic game. Probably the greatest day in the history. So definitely the greatest day in the history of Waterford football. And you can talk about anything else, but to come from 2 down like that was incredible.
Talk to us a little bit about that match, because that sounds bonkers. What a game.
I mean, there was already an epic rivalry there. Hmm. I mean, you had some incredible players on both sides. That great Cork Hibs team, the likes of Carl Davenport, Dave Wigginton, John Lawson, etc., Joe Grady in goal, they were champions. Waterford, your Johnny Matthews, your Alfie Hales, your John O'Neills, your Jimmy McHughes, Vinnie McGuire, Peter Thomas in goal, Alfie Hale, they were incredible side that just somehow managed to keep winning. So the Hibs were in control. They were 2-0 up. They were the better team. And I mean, the other thing that's probably not talked about too much is a lot of the Waterford fans had headed for home, and they actually missed the great comeback, because they were reduced to 10 men. And I think Johnny Matthews was the star that day, and they somehow came back from 2-0 down to win the game 3-2. Flower Lodge was absolutely packed. Nobody was being turned away with. There was no sellout crowds in those days, because if you had your money, you were getting in.
those broken gates again, eh?
Absolutely. Or health and safety. Well, they'll take money, and if they did try and close the gates, they'd be broken down. So, but it was an incredible day. And for Waterford to win the league like that, to dethrone the champions, and then a week later to face each other in Dalymount Park, how Hibs picked themselves up off the floor. Now, I said they won 3-0. It was a Mike Dennehy hat-trick. For over an hour in that game, Waterford were playing really, really well, probably edging it. It was still scoreless. And Maya got the breakthrough with 25 minutes to go. And that kind of changed the game. He scored a second shortly after that, got a third near the end. So it 3-0 might sound like a hammering, but it was another epic battle. But the least Hibs deserved was the cup when Waterford had taken their league title. But they were titanic battles in those days whenever those teams meet. And of course, I should also mention Cork Celtic, because there were two teams in Cork at the time, and Celtic were also incredibly strong as well, and they were up there battling. They'd lost a couple of cup finals in the 60s. They'd lost a league playoff to Shelburne in the early 60s. And so they were kind of the nearly men as well, before eventually making the breakthrough and taking Waterford's title.
Mm. I've got it here in front of me, but I just want to read out this for just to give people an example. So if we go from, I suppose, 68, 69 through to, we'll say, the mid-70s, you had in first, second, third, you had Waterford, Shamrock Rovers, Cork Hibs, Waterford, Shamrock Rovers, Cork Hibs, Shamrock Rovers, Waterford, Waterford, Cork Hibs, Bohemians, Waterford, Finn Harps, Bohemians, Cork Celtic, Bohemians, Cork Hibs. So those teams are filled with great teams, but obviously there can only be one at the top. So it's really this incredible period where you get four or five really good teams competing for both cup and league, and it's all kind of swirling around. It sounds fascinating.
It was. And I mean, I remember, I started going as a 4-year-old in 1971. And I remember those Waterford and Cork Hibs teams coming to Limerick and inflicting some hammerings as well. Because Limerick kind of went into decline a little bit, having won the cup. And certainly by 73, 74, we were down near the bottom of the league, getting knocked out of the cup by Transport. But I remember 71-2, 72-3, I think Waterford scoring 6 one time in the Markets Field. Hibs absolutely demolishing Limerick at the time as well. they were, Hibs and Waterford in particular, were the two teams. And Hibs were a bit like the glamour club. They were the one, I don't know, the...
The Spice Boys of...
Spice Boys, the ones to be seen. Waterford were very much the ones that got the job done. And, I mean, it wasn't through luck. There might have been close margins in those titles. There might have been a lot of 1-0 wins. But they were the team that were able to get it done over 26 games, to get it over the line and to win the title. And they always managed to do it. And said 6 leagues in 8 seasons. Mm. That speaks for itself. The incredible thing is that Waterford have been playing League of Ireland football for, what is it, 95 years now, since 1930. And they've won 6 leagues. They're the only 6 leagues they've won.
Wow.
They came so close in the 50s. I suppose they haven't come too close since, but they came. There was plenty of other times when they came close, but that period, that team were just so dominant, and it's incredible what they did.
I just wanted to come back to that Bowes team as well, just to kind of close the loop a little bit on that in terms of, so Bowes come back, they win the league in 75. Was it an admonishment or whatever you want to call it of going professional that would in, I suppose, 5-6 seasons, they had won 2 major trophies. They were, I suppose, what you might call back as a major force in Dublin. And I suppose they won their first league title in about, what, 30, 40 years, something like that as well.
Yeah, so I mean, it is a sign that they were... So Bowes were building, Bowes were coming. I think you mentioned they came second or third there in the kid. I'll go on and talk about Celtic's triumph in 73-4 in a few minutes. But Bowes were certainly a coming team. It probably helped that Hibs were heading into decline. Waterford were starting to decline. Having won the league in 73, they were still competitive for much of the rest of the 70s. And obviously they won the cup in 1980. Mm. But they weren't the force they were. I mean, some of the players had just kind of gone maybe that little bit stale or gone over the hill or whatever. But it was probably a good time for Bowes to come through. Shamrock Rovers were actually down at the bottom of the league at the time. I know Home Farm won the cup in 75, but that was a huge shock, beating Shelburne in the final. And even Shells weren't that competitive at the time either. So the chances were there for Bowes. They came through to win the league in 75, the cup in 76. They won the league again, I think, was at 78. It was definitely the benefits of professionalism. They were able to sign players. They were able to keep players. They had a fantastic manager in Billy Young. And it all came together at the right time.
Yeah. So if you look at it, they from 72 onwards, they're third, second, and then they win the league in 75. So they were certainly hanging around waiting for their opportunity to take as well. And it was a very good Bowes team that won the league in 75 as well, because they win by, was it 9-10 points, something along there?
Yeah, they were dominant. And I think if you look back, there'll be a lot of 1-0 wins. Or I mean, I remember a few 0-0 draws in the Markets Field. I also remember actually a 4-3. They beat us 4-3 as well, but that was very much an anomaly, I think, at the time.
Yeah, just looking at it here, there is a lot of 1-0 wins in that season. But again, if you're striving to win things, who cares, right? I mean, you don't need to win 5-0 every match.
Absolutely. It is a sign of a good team. It's a sign of that if you can, any champions, they have to be able to win when they're not playing that well, or they have to be able to go away from home and eke out those 1-0 wins. And certainly Bowes, they were very capable of doing it, of going away, either getting a draw or getting a win when they're not playing well, when they're up against the odds, maybe going down the country, maybe the pitches weren't the greatest. Certainly pitches weren't the greatest at the time, with the exception maybe of Milltown. And I include Dalymount in that, by the way. With the exception of Milltown for Shamrock Rovers and Flower Lodge for Cork Hibs, the pitches in the 70s in the League of Ireland wouldn't have been certainly the best.
I wanted to come back to this... to this Waterford side as well, because I mean, of all the teams that we've talked about on this on the podcast so far, this has got to be up there, probably as one of the best kind of periods for a team in all of League of Ireland. As you say, they won six titles and they won them in this period, and that was that. We're moving into the 70s. They won in 68, 69 and 70. They would win in 72 and 73 as well. But talk to us a little bit about this kind of Waterford team. We kind of talked about it before in terms of bringing us up to the late 60s, early 70s. Is this a team that, do you know, that kind of like kind of has the same players, or does it evolve with players over that kind of eight season kind of period?
So there's quite a few of them. There was only two players were involved from the 65-66 title that still won the league in 73, and they were John O'Neill and Johnny Matthews. And Johnny deserved the league medal in 65-66. He made a huge difference when he arrived during the season. But in the very strict rules in those days, he didn't actually get a medal despite making a huge contribution. I think he got one. I can't remember if he got one retrospectively now. I could be wrong on that. He certainly deserved one. But you had the likes of Peter Thomas was there. I think he got five. Alfie Hale would have got five. I mean, some of the names, I'd have to look at the number of games they played and medals they got, but there were other players. Jackie Morley, a Corkman, was there for some of those. He was a fantastic player, fantastic footballer. So he played with Hibs as well. And you had the likes of Jimmy McGough, Vinnie Maguire, Dave Kirby, who went on to play for Limerick, was in at the end, and he was certainly there in 72 and 73. So there was a few. I mean, the likes of Tommy McConville even played with Waterford for at least one season. Mick Leach was there. I think he would have got one of the medals. He was great Shamrock Rovers striker. So there were a lot of key names in Irish football that were there, but the big ones would be Peter Thomas in goal, Johnny Matthews, John O'Neill, and Alfie Hale, of course. Al Finucane, one of the greats of Irish football, we talked about in Limerick.
Yeah.
I mean, he signed for Waterford in the summer of 1973. So Al actually never won a league medal. He was captaining Waterford to the Cup in 1980 on the same day that Limerick won the league in Athlone.
Wow.
And a lot of the players he had played with, you know, he obviously captained Limerick to that cup win in 1971 as well. Paddy Short, a great Cork man, who I will go on and talk about in that Cork Celtic team. Mm. He actually left Limerick at the end. He was my first hero for Limerick. He left Limerick at the end of 71-72 season. And I remember 5 years of age being devastated when he went to Waterford. And of course, he won that league with Waterford the following season.
Do we know what kind of team it was? We mentioned that Bowes team was very, very much kind of centered around building a good defence, being hard to break down, etc. Do we know what kind of style of football Waterford played for them to win so many titles? Was it kind of the same, or was it more kind of swashbuckling, or what kind of style of football did they play?
Yeah, I suppose they weren't somewhere in between. I suppose they could do everything. I mean, I was very young watching those teams, but Hibs were very much the swashbuckling type, the glamour, the Carl Davenports, etc. Bowes were the very defensive, and so Waterford could probably do everything. I mean, they scored a lot of goals. Peter Thomas was an incredible goalkeeper. They were very tight at the back as well, so you didn't have too much Pep Guardiola-style football in Ireland, or indeed in England in those days anyway.
No such thing as ticky-tacky, no?
No, there wasn't. But, I mean, Waterford had some really, really good football players. I mean, they were well able to play the ball, to pass the ball, to score. And you, in those days, you had to be able to mix it as well. You had your enforcers in the team as well. And if you didn't have some players that could look after themselves, you wouldn't get away with it. In fact, that was, I think, the big problem with Johnny Giles' Shamrock Rovers side. They played some beautiful football, but they got kicked off it a few times.
Yeah, and I suppose that if we look at that and kind of look at, I suppose, keep it down south in terms of Cork as well, Cork is in a unique situation, I think, by the looks of it, in the 70s, where they have two very strong Cork teams. They've got Cork Higgs and Cork Celtic. So talk to us a little bit about those. And I suppose when they met in the league, etc., were they big? I'd imagine they were big derby games, big Titanic games.
They were huge. I mean, there's talk of attendances being 17, 18, 19,000 when maybe other games get 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000. I mean, the attendances were still very good in those days. Hibs were definitely the better supported, and Fleur Lodge was probably the better ground. I mean, Turner's Cross was a very, very basic ground well into the 80s. But the derbies were Titanic games. Hibs had the upper hand. So Celtic hadn't won a derby since 1968 when they went into the 73-74 season. And Hibs, of course, had won two FAI Cups in a row. Hibs had won the league in 71. Yeah. Celtic had won a Shield back in the 60s. They maybe won a Dublin City Cup, a top four. But these were minor trophies. So Celtic had never won a major trophy. They'd lost two FAI Cup finals. They'd lost the league in a playoff to Shelburne. Then they lost two FAI Cup finals in the 60s, both after replays to Shamrock Rovers. The first and the last of the six in a row were both FAI Cup wins, were both against Cork Celtic. So you fast forward to 1973-74, and the derbies were big games. A lot of people would actually go and watch both teams, but Hibs were very much the better supported side. But start of 73-74, Waterford had won the six leagues in eight seasons. Paul O'Donovan, the golden boy of Cork football, Cork Celtic, was the manager. They started the season, well, they had a disappointing draw with Finn Harps, and they went up to Dalymount Park on the second day of the season, and Bohemians, Cork Celtic, and Bowes won by 7-0. And Paul O'Donovan was interviewed by the I think with the Examiner, or certainly a Cork reporter afterwards, and he said, "We've got an Everest to climb." And he says, "With all due respects, Paul, I don't think you'd even make it up Patrick's Hill." Hibs actually, I think they won the next game. Then they lost the derby to Celtic. Sorry, Celtic lost the derby to Hibs. So they weren't even being talked about as title contenders. And what followed was, he was a 21-match unbeaten run when Celtic totally turned it around. And one of the big ones was they won the derby. They beat Hibs in the return match. And they pulled off some fantastic wins. They beat Waterford. I think they beat Bowes in the return. And now it was also helped by making some key signings. The directors helped Paul O'Donovan after that defeat. They managed to sign Bobby Tambling. Now, Bobby Tambling had been in the record books as Chelsea's all-time leading goal scorer, I think with over 200 goals. And Frank Lampard only broke the record there in recent years. But Bobby was a Jehovah's Witness, and he was living in Cork and trying to talk to people, knocking on doors as the Jehovah's Witnesses do. So the Celtic approached him and asked him, would he play? And he did. And he scored quite a few goals for them. I mean, if you're able to score goals in the top flight in England for Chelsea, you'll be well able to score them for Cork Celtic. They also signed Big Ben Hannigan, who he'd won the league with a legend with Shelburne, played for Shelburne for many years in the 60s, also won the league with Dundalk. So it was near the end of his days, but he came down south and made a difference to that team. And then in January, when things were going well, they managed to sign Alfie Hale from Waterford. Wow. So they had players who'd actually tasted success at the highest level, along with players like Alec Ludzik, Blondie Carroll, Keith Edwards. So they had some very good local players as well. And they managed to win the league. They won it actually with a game to spare. They beat St. Pat's 3-0 at Turner's Cross on the second last day to make them champions. And it was the only league title for Cork Celtic, but well-deserved after so many near misses in the 60s.
Mm. And what was that undefeated period? What is it, 21 games, did you say?
I think it was 21 games they went undefeated. It was a 26-match campaign, and they'd lost to Bowes on their first away game. I think their second away game, they lost to Fleur Lodge to Hibs. And I think they went undefeated after that to clinch the league title.
Yeah, and talk to us about that Cork Celtic team, because it's kind of a strange one, because they kind of almost appear a little bit and then disappear again after that 74-75 season. Like they were kind of in thereabouts, kind of mid table ish, kind of, weren't they, for a while? They win the league and they kind of go back to that again. Was it just that kind of culmination of, as you say, those players that you talk about? It all came together in a fabulous season, and then it melted away after that.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it was also a very they were owned by Piers Moore, and I think he's the man credited with bringing George Best to Cork Celtic as well subsequently. But they did lose a lot of those players again, having won the league. They also lost a lot of money the following season. In those days, playing in Europe was very much dependent on the draw. Mm. And Celtic drew, they actually drew Ammonia Nicosia of Cyprus in the first round, but there was actually a war in Cyprus at the time, and they were given a walkover. Ammonia had to withdraw. So in the second round, they were drawn against the champions of the Soviet Union, which is Ararat Yerevan in modern-day Armenia. Now, it actually was a really big draw. In fact, they were really talented players, but I mean, nobody in Cork would have heard of any of them. And Celtic were well beaten. They were beaten 2-1 at home and then beaten 5-0, but the cost of travelling, it actually cost them an absolute arm and a leg. So I think that they would have lost significantly on that tie. Now, that Ararat Yerevan side, actually, I don't know if any Irish fans are heading there in September. We've been there a couple of times, actually. That's right. There's a monument. Mm-hmm. There's a monument to that Ararat side. Now, not because of their win over Cork Celtic, but at the
big letters at the bottom, defeated Cork Celtic, and that's it. No other.
that win over Cork Celtic put them into the quarterfinals. Now, obviously, they were Soviet champions, which was quite an achievement in those days as well. But they actually played Bayern Munich, who were the holders of the European Cup, and went on to win 3 in a row. But in the quarterfinals, Bayern actually scored 2 late goals in Germany to beat them 2-0. They went to the second leg in Yerevan, and Ararat actually scored in the first half. They beat Bayern 1-0. And they were very close to knocking them out. It was a fantastic occasion, fantastic display. And there's actually a monument to that side that were Soviet champions that beat Bayern Munich. Wow. And it's at the Horazden Stadium. I don't think it's actually in use anymore. And it's actually far bigger than the stadium that is in use for the Armenian national team. But if you visit it there, there is a monument to that Ararat side. And it's outside. Anyone can walk up. It's open all the time. And said the team that beat Bayern Munich, the Soviet champions, also beat Cork Celtic. But Celtic lost a lot of money at that time. Piers Moore, there were certainly some disputes at the time. All the newspapers were banned from Turner's Cross at one point. It was certainly an interesting time in the mid-70s with that Cork Celtic side. As I said, they signed George Best. He played a few games for them. But you're right, they didn't really compete after that. And sadly, they went out. They didn't see out the 1970s. I mean, Hibs went out of football in 1976. Celtic went out in the summer of 1979. So the great Cork derbies that were drawing 19,000 people in the early 70s, neither club existed at the end of the decade.
Wow, yeah. So by the end of the 70s, there was no Cork team officially?
No, we still had Cork football. So it was actually, so Albert Rovers or Cork Alberts replaced Cork Hibs. So you still actually had two teams in Cork up until 78-79. Now, Cork Alberts or Albert Rovers, I think they were effectively the same club with a couple of name changes. They went out of football in 1979 as well. So you had a new Cork club came in, Cork United, and they actually lasted for 3 seasons. And when they went bust in 1982, you actually had no Cork. You had no football in Cork for 82, 83, or 83-84 season until Cork City joined the league in 1984. So from having two clubs for the 50s, 60s, 70s, even you had no club by the early 80s.
Maybe that's what Cork needs, is their own massive statue that just has the list of every single Cork club's name scrolled across giant like marble tablets or something, because it would surely that would be like a whole monument on its own, the amount of Cork clubs that there's been.
It probably would, but I mean people can joke about there being so many Cork clubs. There have been so many successful Cork clubs.
100%.
Right back to Fortsons and the first club to win bring the FAI Cup to Leaside. Pretty much every club they've had has been hugely. The famous Cork United in the 40s, Cork Athletic, incredibly successful. Cork Habs, Cork Celtic, and obviously Cork City have won quite a lot.
Yeah, is that probably the great curse of Cork football, that they actually appear, they are very successful, but then that success just kind of implodes everything on top of it anyway?
Yeah, well, it's happened a lot in Irish football, actually, with clubs.
You don't say, Gary.
hopefully those days are over, but it has happened so much with clubs being successful, running up huge debts, and then not being able to service them, etc. But it's not just the story.
And speaking of that as well, I want to talk to you about, I suppose, one of the great losses of Irish football in terms of a football club, because it happened in the 70s too, which was Drumcondra. You mentioned it at the start of the show. We've talked about Drumcondra before on the show, but I suppose give us a little bit of executive summary of Drumcondra, quite a successful club.
A hugely successful club. So they became, I think it's the last non-league club, the last non-league club to win the FAI Cup in 1927, and came into the league after that. They were hugely successful, won the league in the 40s, won FAI Cups, beat Shamrock Rovers. They were epic Dublin derbies. The original epic Dublin derbies were Drums and Rovers, right into the 40s, into the 50s. They had huge support in Talca Park. I mean, even the likes of Bertie Hearn growing up was a Drumcondra fan. Plenty of support in Dublin. And actually, a lot of League of Ireland fans were lost when Drumcondra actually went down to football, that they never really transferred, couldn't really transfer their allegiances anywhere else. And their allegiances were to the blue and gold of Drumcondra. I mean, they were made some great runs in Europe. I mean, people talk about Cork City's famous draw with Bayern Munich. Shamrock Rovers, in fairness, not only drew with Bayern Munich, they were 4 minutes away from knocking them out when Bayern went on to win their first European trophy. But Drumcondra actually beat Bayern Munich in Europe. They beat them 1-0, lost 6-1 in aggregate, but they did beat them 1-0 in Dublin and Talca. So they played the likes of Atletico Madrid, Eintracht Frankfurt, Bayern Munich, Nuremberg, the great East German side, ASK Vorwärts. So they played some big names in Europe in the 60s, won the league in 19... I did talk about this before. They won the league in 1965, turned out to be the last time they won the league. But rock bottom in 64-65 was Waterford. And Sam Prohl, the legendary Prohl family that owned Drumcondra, Sam stood up at the league meeting and told Waterford they need to pull their socks up. And of course, famously, Waterford won 6 of the next 8 league titles. And as they were winning their 8th, Drumcondra were going out of business. Winning their 6th in the 8th season. 8 seasons later, Drumcondra were going out of business. So an incredible turnaround. I mean, the crowds, they had dwindled big time as you went into the early 70s. And Drums, obviously the running costs were very high. And I think just the... I think there is some regrets in the Prohl family, because there was a deal done with Home Farm, and I don't want to get too much into what went on, but I think there was, I suppose I want to be careful what I say as well, even 50-odd years on, but I think there was a feeling that they originally were meant to play as Home Farm Drumcondra, and they did play as Home Farm Drumcondra very briefly, but then just became Home Farm, but it was a different club. I mean, Drumcondra I know there is a club that has taken the name now in the Leinster League that were founded again or refounded. I think they claim as well. So that might be a little bit up for debate as well. But certainly the club that the Prole family had, that Drumcondra club, went out of business in 1973 season, and they're a sad, sad loss to the League of Ireland.
Yeah. It's kind of, was it indicative of what was happening in the league at the time? Gates were down. Lots of people weren't going to the League of Ireland games, etc. And so it kind of just builds up on Drumcondra. They build up this big debt. It was like £6,000 or £7,000 in debt or something like that, that they just couldn't service anymore. And then because of the overall decline of the league, it was just inevitable that at some point it was going to fold.
Yeah, so I mean, it's probably an interesting study, and there's an interesting theory as well. And so, I mean, League of Ireland gates in the 50s and 60s were huge. And certainly in the likes of Cork and Waterford, there were still huge crowds going to games in the early 70s. But definitely in Dublin, the crowds were dropping off. And I did speak to somebody many years ago, and there was a little bit of a resentment. There were a Shamrock Rovers fan going to Milltown in the early 70s, and the Rovers gates fell off. Now, Rovers went into decline, so I'm not sure whether it's the gates caused the decline or the decline caused the lack of the gates. But also what happened in around 1972, 1973 in Dublin was the rise of Dublin GAA. So Dublin Gaelic football, I mean, GAA in Dublin hardly existed. It was country people up in Dublin bringing the GAA up from rural. But what happened in 1972-73 was the rise of the Dubs. And I mean, it's still to this day, many people who follow football, who follow League of Ireland football, go and watch the national team abroad. Those from Dublin will be seen on Hill 16 supporting Dublin. And the whole Hill 16 culture seemed to start around 1972-73. And this person was telling me that most of his mates deserted Shamrock Rovers, and he never really forgave them for it. They gave up on Milltown, and they went to... And of course, we played on Sundays. Our League of Ireland football was on a Sunday in those days as well. Mm. So the glamour and the Heffo's Army and the whole Hill 16 culture, that, I think, did have an impact, certainly on football in Dublin. And while there were still big crowds in Waterford and Cork, they started to decline as well after that. And certainly the mid-70s saw a huge decline in the crowds that were going to watch any of our clubs.
Yeah. I read in the book, No Foreign Game is a really good book. I love reading it. And it says, and I'll quote directly from it. It says, by the early 1970s, it was clear that the League of Ireland was in serious trouble. Between 1969 and 1973, gates declined by 60% across the league. That's a huge kind of drop in the amount of people going to league games, over half. And it's interesting that you mentioned that, because I read another theory, which was the advent of television as well. So television was becoming more popular in Ireland, etc. You were able to get, in some places anyway, particularly in Dublin, you could get BBC channels, English channels, and that meant you were able to watch things like Match of the Day, which would have been hugely influential for people in terms of supporting teams that were in England. Irish players, of course, had been in English teams for decades and decades and decades. And so it became this kind of rise in, I suppose, supporting, finding an English team to support, whoever that might be, your Everton, your Liverpool, your Manchester United, your Wolves or your Tottenham, whatever it was, because you were able to see, you know, these kind of big glamour teams, you know, with stadiums filled, etc., and you could watch it on Match of the Day, etc. And so if you compare that to going to, you know, 2,500 people in, you know, on a pitch that's pretty awful, then I suppose the glamour kind of wins out and people kind of drifted away from the game from there as well, which I think is probably a reasonable theory. Yes, no?
No, I think that did have an impact as well. I mean, the East Coast of the country, so obviously the likes of Dundalk, right down to Dublin, you could get all the British channels. If you go down to even Waterford in those days, could get the Welsh channels, so they could get Match of the Day. And another big one was the big match on ITV was always on a Sunday afternoon. Mm. So if you, people not only watching Match of the Day on a Saturday night, but they could watch the big match on a Sunday afternoon, which would have highlights of different games. So that sitting at home, it might be a bit cold or a bit wet outside, and say, you couldn't really record stuff in those days. I don't even know if VCRs, they certainly weren't, they weren't commonplace. So you could certainly either, if you wanted to watch Man United or Liverpool in the big match, or you could go out and watch Shamrock Rovers or Bowes in the cold and the rain. And so a lot of people, I think, did decide. And I suppose the other thing is, as you moved into the 70s in Ireland, people had more choice and other things to do on Sunday afternoons. And so it wasn't really just associated with going to football. Now, it's interesting you said the 60% decline, because that's still in place. And we're talking about 25,000 people in 1972 in Flower Lodge, 19, 17, 18,000 at Cork Derbies. There were huge crowds in Kilcone Park in those days. And but interestingly, Cork Celtic, when they won the league in 1974, they only had 5,000 people at the St. Pat's game that clinched the title at home. And that was seen as being a big disappointment. Mm. And I suppose it makes sense when you could, there were 17,000 watching them against Hibs. Now, a lot of them would have been Hibs fans, but a lot of them didn't fancy going to Turner's Cross to see their rivals lift the title, I suppose.
But it's just, I find it interesting that and I suppose these are the questions that we've kind of come back to ask again for the modern era too. We've seen huge gates now by comparison, I suppose, of the previous decade from now. So it throws in the question as well, that kind of attraction and the attraction of the League of Ireland and how do you attract kind of fans, but also new fans as well, which I think has been very interesting to see. And as you pointed out as well, the competition now from sports that are not just Irish based in terms of GAA or rugby, but we're seeing American football games now coming to play in Ireland. We're seeing, you know, all these kind of different sports as well that are serious competition for the League of Ireland. And yet the League of Ireland still is making inroads into that, which I find interesting too. Yeah.
Yeah, in many ways, it seems to have come full circle. Yeah. In that, I mean, if you go back to the 50s, a lot of people went to the League of Ireland on Sunday afternoon because they had nothing else to do. Now there is so much to occupy your time. There's so much to do. But the allure of live football on a Friday night has probably come back, and people have realised maybe all this glitz and glamour on Sky is not all it's cracked up to be. And actually going with your mates on a Friday night to watch Bowes, to watch Rovers, to watch Shells, etc., Pats. Certainly in Dublin, it's been a huge success. And the league, now, say a fan of a first division club, I think I'm watching a different sport sometimes, but it's fantastic to see the success of the League of Ireland, certainly the Premier Division, and not just in Dublin. The likes of Waterford, Galway, Cork City are also drawing huge crowds. Sligo is always a fantastic club in the Northwest and brilliant supporters. But I'd love to see it trickle down a bit to the First Division, because no fear of sellout crowds where we're going. But it probably has come full circle from the decline in the 70s because of television to maybe people waking up and saying there's live football on their doorstep, and it's a totally different product to what you're consuming in a pub on a bar stool or at home in your sofa.
Absolutely, yeah. It's a lived experience, though, isn't it? It's that kind of lived experience, not just with you and your mates, but with, you know, the 3,000, 4,000 other people that are turning up to the game with you, and you're all in it together kind of type of thing. I think people are living that again, aren't they?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's great to see, and I wish we had it in Limerick as well.
Soon, hopefully soon.
Absolutely, on its way.
Yeah, and it's interesting you mentioned Sligo Rovers as well, because let's kind of tie up the 70s kind of decade in a bit of a bow here. Sligo Rovers win the league in 76, 77. Is that kind of out of nowhere? Because they're not anywhere near a league title, we'll say, what, in the seven or eight seasons before that. So where does this come from?
It comes from nowhere. It comes from absolutely nowhere. Billy Sinclair, an auditor, came down to manage them. I mean, look, Sligo have always been a fantastic club, but I don't think... No, they did. So they got to the League Cup final in 75, 76. I will mention a Limerick involvement in a couple of these. Limerick actually beat them over two legs to win the League Cup in 75, 76. I don't think anyone expected him to win the league in 76, 77 from the start of the season. Billy Sinclair did a fantastic job there. The likes of, I'm going to forget some of these players, like Tony Fagan, Tony Stenson, Paul McGee up front scoring the goals. I think David Pugh was still involved as well at that stage. There's some very good players at Sligo, but it did kind of come from nowhere to win that league, an incredible achievement to win the title. And of course, I have to talk about John Carpenter in 1978 because the following season, I mean, I suppose 77-78, John Giles, John Carpenter, there's a lot of things get tied in to that season. So Johnny Giles arrived in the summer of 1977 to change Irish football, and he certainly did. I mean, he was playing himself. He had the likes of Ray Tracy. I think Paddy Mulligan played in that Rovers team. Eamon Dunphy came back and played. They played some lovely football, and he actually talked about changing Irish football, possibly competing to win a European trophy. And they did win the cup, but it really wasn't until the arrival of Jim McLaughlin, which is a different podcast, I think, that Shamrock Rovers started winning leagues. But that cup final in 1978, it was decided by a very, very controversial penalty in, I think, added first half injury time, which mightn't have been controversial, which could have been controversial as well. And it was given for a very dubious handball. And certainly referee John Carpenter was not very popular in Sligo for that decision. And I don't think he was ever very welcome after that. And ironically, I should circle this back to Cork Celtic in 1974, because Celtic won the league in 74, but many people in Cork will say they should have won the double. And again, my own father was involved in this, but he was an innocent party, but I will tell the full story. So as some people might know, my father was a League of Ireland referee and a linesman for the 70s. And I actually, not only was I going to the Marcus Field, but I'd sit into the car with him and I'd end up going to Kilcone Park and go to St. Mel's Park. But he wouldn't actually bring me to Cork. He wouldn't bring me to Cork in those days because of the crowds. It was just too much. I was too young. I was going at 7, 8. And I was sitting on my own in the stand and he was out on the pitch. I mean, it sounds ridiculous now, but a different time. But in one of his early games as a linesman was with John Carpenter. Now, John Carpenter was probably the best referee. He was definitely the best referee in his day and arguably one of the best referees of all time in the League of Ireland. He officiated at huge European games and everything, but he was also incredibly controversial. And Cork Celtic were playing Drogheda in a cup. They drew up in Lourdes Stadium. It was a midweek replay in Turner's Cross. An absolutely cracking cup tie. Drogheda took the lead. Ben Hannigan, I think it was Ben Hannigan, equalised. And with 2 minutes to go, Ben Hannigan rose to head home across to win the tie for Cork Celtic. And I think the ball went through the net or something. John Carpenter was caught on the turn. It was another Limerick linesman, not my dad, on the far side. My dad was on the other end of the pitch. There was another Limerick linesman who was looking across, and George actually looked across, couldn't see it. And there were the only two people in the ground that hadn't seen it was a goal. And the draw, the keeper would quite cleverly put the ball down for a goal kick. John Carpenter gave the goal kick, and there was a riot. So they were throwing stones. The police had been, the guards had to be called, and they were locked in the dressing room for 2 hours after the game. And as they're sitting in the dressing room, my dad says to John and George, he says, you know, that was a goal. It definitely went through the net. I could see it from the other end of the pitch. And he actually said, if you say one word about this to the press, you'll be off.
That's the end of your refereeing career.
Yeah. So, but they were locked in. John missed his train back to Dublin. My dad's car was outside, and I think he drove, if I remember, he drove a Dublin Reg car at the time, because famously he often had a Dublin Reg car because he was a sales rep and the cars would have been from Dublin.
Yeah.
He famously, a Limerick Shamrock Rovers cup tie a few years afterwards, his car was parked in the same spot outside the Markets Field all season. But the Dublin Reg car got done probably by our own fans, we have to guess, because the Rovers fans were hardly going to do a Dublin Reg car. But anyway, that's a different story. But
it probably saved him that day, though, didn't it?
He was afraid they'd think it was John Carpenter's car with the Dublin Reg. but John had come down on the train. But actually, the other thing was there was meant to be extra time played that day, which wasn't played. The game went to a third game up in Drogheda. Drogheda beat them. And Celtic fans still maintain that they would have won the cup that season. Now, it was another famous cup. Finn Harps beat St. Pat's in the cup final. So I'm sure Finn Harps fans will hotly dispute that.
But that brings me along as well, because Finn Harps is another interesting story from the decade too, along with the many other we've already discussed, because they kind of do the same. They kind of appear and are quite competitive, aren't they? They do by the standard of the day, they do quite well.
No, they were very strong. I mean, they came in 1969. They joined the league. And I mean, people, they famously lost to Shamrock Rovers 10-2. I think it was in the Dublin City Cup tie in their first home game in Finn Park. And people thought, oh, Harps are going to be rubbish. It's going to be a disaster. Mm. Finn Harps' next home defeat in any competition was on the last day of the season when Waterford went there and won to win the league. So they went on beaten in Finn Park all that season. People talk about until the last day. So people talk about the 10-2, but the Harps became very competitive very fast. I think they finished second or third. They qualified for the UEFA Cup and played Aberdeen. They won the Cup in 74. They reached Europe again. They actually, well, I better not mention the Derby County result, but they have a record defeat for an Irish side in Europe, and they met Derby County. Let's say it was a 17-goal thriller over two legs. And they also played Everton, actually, in the UEFA Cup in 78-79. But I don't think Harps haven't actually been in Europe since, if I recall correctly. But they were very strong in the 70s. They were up near the top of the league. They won the Cup in 74, which was a fantastic achievement. Probably should have won more than that. Certainly were in contention for a couple of league titles.
And it's one of those kind of great kind of ironies that we seem to have this wonderful decade of Irish football with so many like really competitive great teams, but there's not people going to see them. And I suppose that's probably one of the big opportunities missed, I suppose, for the League of Ireland that kind of set us up to, I suppose, the decline that it's been in the past 20, 30 years as well, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose maybe I was a little bit fortunate in my own way that I was only able to go because I was so young that my dad and my grandfather would bring me when the crowds weren't so big, which was probably true in the Markets Field after the Cup win in 71. But a lot of the time in those days, people would pick and choose their matches. So I remember in the Markets Field, there might be 200 or 300, and suddenly Johnny Giles is bringing Shamrock Rovers and the place is mobbed. Or when the FAI Cup comes around, a lot of fans have come out of the woodwork. So we might play Waterford in the 70s in the league in front of a few hundred people, and there could be 10 times as many there if we play them a week later in the Cup. So a lot of fans would pick and choose their games. They'd come out for the big Cup ties. You get a little bit of excitement. I mean, I talked about Sligo Rovers winning the league in 77. Limerick went up and beat them 4-1 in the Showgrounds in the first round of the FAI Cup. And suddenly there was Limerick actually got to the final that year, and suddenly fans were coming out of the woodwork that probably hadn't been to a league game earlier in the season. So there was, and that wasn't just Limerick. You'd see that in Waterford and Cork as well. Cork Celtic crowds. I mean, Celtic were bringing in the likes of George Best. Waterford brought in Bobby Charlton. There were Gordon Banks played for Pats. Uwe Saylor played for Cork Celtic as well. Some huge names in world football were actually being brought over, mainly to bring a crowd, mainly to attract gates and everything like that. So the crowds had changed from a couple of hundred to a few thousand.
I wanted to cap off the episode by talking about Bows again, if we bring it full circle, because they win in 77-78. So since they go professional in 69, they win, and I stand to be corrected here, 2 league titles and 2 FAI Cups during the 70s. So that kind of pro turn really brings Bows on as a football club, doesn't it?
Well, it does, absolutely. And I mean, they won the Cup in 76 as well, beat Drogheda in the final. And as you said, they won the 2 league titles. Were still hugely competitive up there, right at the top of the league in the early 80s as well. So, yeah, I mean, professionalism changed Bows completely and utterly. And I don't think there's any argument to that they had been for the 50s and 60s, down near the bottom of the league, not competing, not for honours, suddenly to being certainly the top club in Dublin and one of the top clubs in the country.
Yeah, fantastic. I think we'll probably leave it there, and we'll come back to probably 70. Excuse me, to Dundalk 79, and then you can spend the rest of the episode talking about Limerick winning the league in 1980. You can,
absolutely, we haven't done justice to Jim McLaughlin's Dundalk in the 70s either as well. We'll have to talk about that, and obviously, well, to Jim McLaughlin as well. But I have to talk about 1980 as well, obviously. Yeah.
And Drogheda as well. We didn't mention Drogheda, who were a competitive team in the 70s as well. No, and also, we didn't talk enough about, and we'll probably do this in the next episode, because I interviewed Owen Hand recently, and that'll be a podcast coming up in the next couple of weeks. But we talked quite a lot about Johnny Giles as well, and how he changed football and how he changed Shamrock Rovers, etc., and kind of brought kind of that professionalism really to the forefront of what they were doing. So I did talk about Owen, about what was it about Johnny and his managerial style, etc. So I think that's maybe another podcast on its own, but it's definitely something we should talk about as well, because it does bring Shamrock Rovers into the 80s with title winning teams.
I mean Rovers, we've talked about them in the 70s. They had gone way down. I mean, I remember Limerick winning 4-0. I think it was 4-0. It was 4-0 or 4-1 in Milltown. I think it was 4-0 in Milltown in the mid-70s, which would have been unheard of going back even a few years earlier. Certainly would be unheard of today to think of Treaty United going to Tala and winning 4-0.
Never say never. Never say never.
We can dream.
Well, until next time. So, Gary, thank you very much. We dream on till the next episode. Gary, thanks very much as ever, with some fantastic stories and all this, as ever, that great insight into the wonderful decade that was the 70s in Irish football as well. Coming up in the next couple of weeks, we'll obviously be going forward in time, but I think we're going to be talking a little bit more about Northern Ireland football. We'll have that interview with Owen Hand, and then we'll be talking about that golden era of international football with a man by the name of Jack Charlton brought some a little bit of success to Irish international football. But until then, Gary, thanks very much.
Yes.
Well, that's it for this week's show. You can subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you listen to us on, whether it's Spotify, Apple, Amazon Music, or YouTube Podcast, and more. You can find us there. Share the show on your social media as well, and help us spread the word about the podcast and, of course, Irish footballing history. And remember to support your local League of Ireland and Northern Ireland Football League club. It's our heritage. It's our game. Bye for now.